Patrick Chilton, Reel 2.
What's it conditions like on the frontier?
Well, they were very different on there to the plains. The winters are very cold. In fact, we had fires. And, of course, as I mentioned before, we used to campaign in the winter a lot. And on one occasion, as a young platoon subaltern, I went up to one of our pickets at the top of a cud, as we used to call it, and I found he was nearly freezing to death. And to get him down, the first thing we thought was to get him out of his overcoat. And we found the buttons were frozen in. It was as cold as that. Now, on the plains, it was a very different matter, particularly in the summer. In fact, it was so hot that in the plains, we never kept a regiment down there during the summer. We used to keep a security company. And we used to go to the hills. We used to go to Sherat, which was 4,000 feet up. And there, it was a very different matter. But training was then restricted to the cold time of the day. For instance, at Llandicotal, we trained in the morning and the afternoon. In fact, the troops used to play football in the afternoon. When he came down to the plains, we used to start work at 6 in the morning, and we'd finish at 11. And then we'd go to the mess for the officers, and the troops used to go to their canteen. And then we all used to go to bed in the afternoon. And in the evening, the troops used to go and swim and play football. The officers probably go down to the club and play tennis. So it was all a very different type of life on the plains as to what it was right up in the hills.
Could you describe the daily routine up on the frontier?
Well, up on the frontier, we used to get up at reveille, which was 7 o'clock in the morning. And of course, that was all done by bugles in those days. The Gurkhas were beautiful buglers, far better than we were. The last post at night was a really most exhilarating thing to listen to. It was beautiful. Everything was done by bugle. Even if the commanding officer wanted all the officers, he blew a bugle, had it blown, all officers of the double. Everything. We had to know our bugle calls all the time because everything was done by the bugle. So we used to start work at about 8 o'clock. We'd train. A lot of it was drill. We couldn't go outside the camp unless, as I say, we had tribesmen with us, because otherwise we were liable to be shot at. And we used to train most of the morning. And then in the afternoon, the troops used to either play football, or the bingo was a great thing. They used to call it housey-housey in those days. It wasn't bingo. The officers used to take to riding. Thereupon, we used to often hire a tribesman, take us out riding. It sounds rather ridiculous, doesn't it? But just to prevent our being shot at, this is what we had to do. Paid for, of course, by the political agent again, or bribery. And we used to go out riding. Now, we had some very terrifying things up there because the earthquakes were very bad at the time I was there. And I was out riding one day, and suddenly the stillness of everything was astounding. No birds, no nothing, absolute dead stillness, except for my horse's hooves. And then suddenly I could see the mountains moving and the earth opening, and I thought, my goodness, have I had too much port for lunch? And then I realized the rumbling, and it was an earthquake. And I galloped back to camp, and there I found three of our huts were down. Now, they were earthquake-proof because they were built with the walls facing outwards, so that if anything happened, the roof merely fell in, but they weren't crushed by the walls. This was a recognized thing. All the buildings were like that, so nobody was hurt. But I was in the mess one lunchtime, and we had an earthquake, and you've never seen so many officers under a mess table in your life so quickly. Anyhow, to get back to training, that was what we did. We were mountain troops, and we really trained in the mountains. And we had a lot of drill. And, of course, we didn't work as hard as they do in the Rhein Army today. We were very badly paid, and we didn't do a lot of work.
Did you have your own horses?
No. We used to have a thing called sevens. That was, we rented them from the local cavalry regiments. We paid 7 rupees a month. Now, that's terribly cheap because a rupee, 13 rupees to the pound, so we only paid 10 shillings a month because you had to feed him and you had to have your own syce, that is a groom. But for that, I used to have 2 horses for hunting because you needed them in those days. The syce used to bring the other horse. Well, he used to bring both the horses out to the meet. I used to ride by car rather lavishly and get on one horse and he'd follow behind trotting. And then halfway through the hunt, I'd change horses, and then he'd ride the other one back. So it was a very cheap form of entertainment, really. Polo ponies were different. We had a fund called the Polo Fund, and we used to buy our own ponies. The regiment bought them and selected the officers to ride them. And everybody subscribed to the Polo Fund.
What other forms of entertainment was there in the camp?
Well, nothing really. There wasn't any. We played bridge quite a lot. Backgammon wasn't invented, I don't think, then. We had drinks and we used to talk. There were no wives up the Khyber. They were all down Bashar. They used to run what we used to call a passion bus, which used to depart on Friday evenings down the Khyber Pass and come back on Sunday night. The bachelor officers quite often used to go down. I used to go down always because I liked hunting and polo. And then the Bashar Club in the evening always laid on extremely good dinner and dancing. So that was our form of entertainment. But then we used to get up at 4:30 in the morning to hunt. So it wasn't, it had to be rather like Cinderella and get to bed early to be able to rise in the morning and hunt. And then come back to the Bashar Club for lunch. We used to drink John Collins. That was our great drink, which was a mixture of gin and lemonade. And then go back to the Khyber and do another week's work. But of course there were breaks. I'd have to come down during the week to draw the pay for the regiment. Now, drawing the pay involved coming down from Nandikotal to Bashar Bank. I had four men with me. When I arrived in an armoured car, two of them would stand outside with bayonets fixed outside the bank, where I'd preferably go in and draw the money, which was quite a lot of money, and get out and join them, jump into my armoured car, and we'd whistle up back up the Khyber, hoping we weren't going to be shot at. Otherwise, the colonel might be rather annoyed.
You never got stopped by the tribes.
No, I didn't. No, I actually, when I was there, though I escorted a lot of caravans through the pass, I never had experienced any trouble. I think they were too heavily bribed.
But it still wasn't safe to go hunting round the fort. You had to go down.
Oh yes, we couldn't do that. No, we hunted on the plains. Oh, there was no crops up there, you see, for the jackal. All the sugar cane was down, you know, by the Korbal River, which is run through Bashar. That was where the sugar cane was. It was all flat as a handpan. It wasn't very exciting hunting, really. You went like mad after the jackal, but there were hardly any jumps at all.
Were the villages, were there many villages around there? And were they quite glad you were getting rid of the jackals?
I suppose the farmers, I don't think the jackal does any damage, really. He comes in and gets into the swill bins and things like that. That's his main job in life. He's not like the fox. I don't think he actually hurts chickens and things like that. I'm not sure.
But you never had any complaints from
farmers? Oh, no, not a bit, no. They were quite glad to see us, and we didn't do any damage, really. We just put the hounds through their cane, that's all.
What were your quarters like?
Oh, very good at Nandikotal. We had our own sitting room and our own bedroom.
Each officer.
And our own bathroom. But of course the bathroom was a tin tub, and you had to employ an extra servant for your bath, because the bearer certainly wouldn't fill your bath. That wasn't his job. And so you called him a beastie waller. You had a beastie waller. In fact, when on the plains, when we had a bungalow, four of us shared it, we were amazed to find we were employing 16 servants. Because one wouldn't do this, another wouldn't do that. We had to have a gardener. Each had to have a bearer. We had two beastie wallets. We had a chokidar, who is the person who guards your, like a policeman at night, so it prevented a robbery taking place. And we had three sizes, which were the grooms. And we worked it out. We had 16 servants between four officers. You wouldn't see that today.
How much did it cost?
Well, a servant normally got paid 13 rupees a week, which in those days was a pound. And on that he lived on the premises. We gave him what we used to call a godown, where he lived, where he could have his wife and children if he wished. But he did his own cooking, mostly chapatis and things like that. And he seemed to live quite well off a pound a week.
Did you prefer any particular sort of Indian for a particular job?
Well, of course, there was the caste system, and you had to employ the right caste. I mean, the sweeper had to come from the sweeper class. He scrubbed your room out, you know. The beastie waller did the water, the hot water. The gardener had his job. Then we had the bearer, who was the top man of the lot. He was very high caste, a bearer, very high caste indeed. And then the chowkidar used to come at night and he used to walk round the bungalow and see everything was all right at night. But you see, they're all different castes. So we had to employ different people for different jobs. The caste system in those days, I don't know what it's like today, but it was terribly strict in those days. You could never become a bearer unless you were born into a bearer class. And bearers were very funny people. I mean, the colonel always said he'd send a bearer down to me at Karachi to meet me. And when he arrived and I had him, I was very fond of him. As I say, I've always corresponded with him today. Very loyal person. But I was warned by the colonel never to employ a Christian. That was the last person to employ. Because what they wanted to do was to get out of their caste. They'd say they were Christians. They get tattooed with a cross on their chest, which meant, of course, they could drink and they could smoke and they could swear and they could steal, really. So they weren't employable. It's a very sad thing to say, but this is what we were told. Employ a Mohammedan, always. Because, of course, they never drank, never smoked, never swore. And they said their prayers five times a day.
So there was a general preference for
Mohammedans. Well, where I was, because yes. I was in northern India, which is now Pakistan. So we, but if I'd been south, I suppose I would have had Hindus. I don't know.
Do you think you had a better life in India than if you'd stayed in England?
Oh, far better. Far, far better. I mean, to start off, we're far better off financially. We were paid double the pay that we were paid in England. Of course, we had to pay for a rent of our bungalow and our servants, which we got free in England. And of course, our food had to be supplemented. And of course, Mohammedan, or at least I should say Muslim, India was no alcohol. So we had to get special license to bring it up from Bombay, which cost quite a lot extra for our whiskey, which we used to drink in large quantities up there. So yes, but it was a much better life. I mean, the hunting and the joy of, well, we did far less work to start with. Who wouldn't enjoy that? We had great fun, marvellous life, and the club life was wonderful in the evening. Great comradeship out there.
Was it a club for officers of any regiment or just particular regiments?
You mean it was the same for other regiments, do you mean?
The club life you speak of.
Yes.
Who could be members?
British officers.
Of any regiment?
Of any regiment, yes. Mm. Yes. I'm afraid, unfortunately, in those days, we didn't accept Indian officers.
What was daily life like down on the plains?
Well, this was now Shara, which was about 20 miles from Peshawar. It was a different life there because the winter life was great fun. There was the hunting, the usual thing. And in the summer, we had the polo. But as I say, of course, the regiment used to go up the hills. And he was to keep a security regiment down the plains. It was 1 month. Now, it was very hot. When I was on security, it was 120 degrees sometimes in the midday. So the bearer had to keep our veranda always covered with water to try and keep the rooms cool. We ran in there just in case of rats. That's about all, which we were used for. We never had any, but I mean, in case we did. What was interesting was we had to get all our supplies from Sherat, the hill station. And to do that, we used to use a thing called a heliograph. There was no telephone communication. This was worked by the sun. It was a flashing mirror. And though the hill station was 20 miles away, we could get in constant touch with them all the time by heliograph. You worked it with a little screw at the back, so as the sun moved round, you managed to tune in, rather like a wireless station, to the sun. And you'd flash up all your supplies that you required for the next 24 hours, and they'd come down by truck. It was a funny arrangement, but I suppose looking at it logically, of course, you've got the main bulk of your troops up in Sherat, and only a small portion down in Nigeria. So they sent all the supplies to Sherat, and then we had to feed off them. But the hill station was great fun. That was lovely up there. We had one amusing incident. I say amusing, perhaps it was rather serious. We had a man-eating tiger. And the duty officer at night was always given by the adjutant a time with a slip of paper on when he had to do his rounds. This could vary from 11 o'clock till 4 o'clock in the morning, so the sentries never knew when you were coming. Well, I got very frightened of his tiger. I carried a revolver. But he was a man-eating, because he'd eaten 3 children on the plains, and then he was reported up in Shiraz. So we hired a tiger catcher. And he arrived with an enormous van, rather like you put gliders in. It was a very long tube, in which was the bait at the end. And he was very, the children, everybody was very excited at the arrival of this thing. He had flags on it and everything, and told us all how he was going to catch the tiger. Of course, he never did. We never saw the tiger. Perhaps there wasn't one. But it certainly frightened me going round at night at 4 o'clock in the morning. Oh, very early in the summer, very early, 6 o'clock, because of the heat of the day. Of course, a lot of our duties down there were really training for RATs. We were under, of course, the civil law. We were only called out in aid of the civil power. We went on our own initiative. We couldn't do anything. But if there was a RAT, the magistrate would call us out and tell us what to do, and we would do it. And if it came to firing, well, the magistrate would sign the order to fire, not us. We couldn't do anything on our own initiative. That was a precaution against, you know, a rebound of the army firing indiscriminately. The magistrate took responsibility. We only shot one man, and we shot to kill. And we had to grab the body, get him back, so there wouldn't be a sort of scene afterwards of a funeral with demonstrators. So we always buried him ourselves. That was really the main job we had in Nowshera in the summer. It was merely in winter, of course, we trained a lot.
How did you train for a riot?
Well, in aid of the civil power.
Yes.
Well, we used to train, actually. We used to dress our soldiers up as rioters. They used to love that thing, and they used to charge us. And then we had blank, of course, and we have the magistrate dressed up as a buffoon. You know, the usual sort of army thing, and he'd give the order to fire. This, you know, that's what we used to do. And we used to know every street in Nowshera where possibly there might be trouble. But the training there in the winter, of course, was quite serious there. And we used to do brigade training. That was 3 regiments used to go out, and a 4th regiment as enemy. We had one terrible tragedy. The 42nd Punjabi were in our brigade, and we were ordered to cross the Kabul River at night to attack the 13th, 18th Hussars, who were going to be our enemy. They came from Rizalpur. Now, we had a wireless silence, and I was a young junior subaltern wireless operator at the time. And we were going along this pass at about 2 o'clock in the morning. And from the 42nd Punjabi camp, I could see rockets flying, all sorts of things. So I said to my colonel, who was then Brigadier de la Berre, do you think I should break wireless silence and get in touch with the signal officer of the 42nd Punjabi? And he said, oh no, no, there's no need. If they're attacked by Pathans, well, they're quite capable, their whole regiment there, they don't need our help. So we went on, and we got to the Kabul River, and we sat down, and suddenly a brigade major from Nowshera came along and said there's been a terrible tragedy. The 42nd have mutinied. They shot all the British officers except 1 and 3 Indian officers. And you ought to go immediately to the Punjabi camp and put the whole lot under arrest and march them back to Nowshera. Well, this is the most terrible thing for our regiment to have to do. But we did it. And what happened was, there's a thing called Ramadan, which is like Christmas to the Muslims, you know. Very important day. And somebody made a mistake and sent them out on training that night. Now, this is when the moon gets full, and they've fasted for a month, you know, and all this sort of thing, and it's their Christmas, really. And of course, they got very upset about this, and 4 of them ran amok. They went to Colonel Gray's tent, shot him in his bed, shot all the British officers except the adjutant, who was then Captain Cooley, who managed to get the Dogras, who were part of the regiment, who were, of course, not Muslims. And they had machetes, and they cut down all the guy ropes, all the tents, slashed them. got them all down, and then they found them running at the end, rather like a rabbit in a cornfield, and they shot them dead. But that didn't make any difference. The regiment had mutinied. And it was a very sad episode in our lives.
What happened to the men afterwards?
The regiment was disbanded.
What effect did this have on you?
Well, not very much, except it made our rather suspicions always of Punjabis. You know, you never quite knew whether they were going to be loyal. I'm sure they were and are now, but it upset us terribly that such a thing could possibly happen.
Did it have an effect on the British troops too?
Well, I think it did. I think when they heard the news and that we had to do a forced march, because don't forget we'd been marching all through the night as it was, and we had to march back, oh, about 12 miles again on a double march. That's light infantry march. That's not 120 to the minute, it's 160 to the minute, to get there as quick as possible, because we didn't have transport, you see, in those days. We only had mules. And I think they were terribly upset, yes. There was a mass funeral in Nowshera, and of course it was all over the press and everything.
Could you describe conditions in the mess?
Yes, we had a very nice anteroom and a big dining room. Of course, things were very formal in those days. Once a week we had the band, who had to play during dinner. And then we had two forms of mess kit, which we wore every night, except Saturdays and Sundays. In the summer we wore white mess jackets with green facings and white trews. And in the winter, of course, we wore our red mess jackets with green facings and our trews. Always we'd wait for the colonel to come in. Now, there were always a lot of officers in the mess in those days because the wives, a lot of them were left behind in England. So we always had quite a few senior officers. And the standard there was we'd go in to the anteroom and have a pink gin, which was generally the drink out there. They always said it clears the pipes rather well. And we'd wait for the colonel. And he'd come in, he'd have his drink, and then he said, "Gentlemen, we'll wait for dinner to be served." Now the head, not the khitmatgar, this was a British sergeant, would come in. Of course, we had Indian servants there, khitmatgars, but the British sergeant was in charge of them all, and he would announce dinner. He'd come in, as usual, hands behind his back, open the swing doors, and say, "Gentlemen, dinner is now served." And we'd all troop in, the colonel leading, of course. And there we'd have a long table, every night, covered in silver, and with what was rather odd was a punkawalla. Now, a punkawalla was in charge of what we call air conditioning today. There was a long bamboo right across the table with a big sort of heavy material on the bottom. He lay on the floor in a corner with a cord with his toe, and he worked this thing backwards and forwards so that we could eat with a sort of slight breeze blowing. Our dinner was very much the same as it is in the English messes today. It started off with sherry, and you had your soup and your fish and your main course and a savoury. And then the ceremony of toasting the Queen took place every night with the Vice President and the President. I mean, the President would say, "Gentlemen," or "Mr. Vice," "the Queen," and he would then repeat, "Gentlemen, the Queen." And we'd stand up, and we toast the Queen in port. Then after dinner, of course, it was what anybody wanted to do. It was either billiards or bridge or something of that sort, or we might be able to go out.
If you went out, what sort of places would you go to?
Well, only the club or the cinema. They were the only two places to go to, really, or to somebody else's bungalow, which we used to go and drink in sometimes, or play bridge or something. No, we were very limited at night. We couldn't go into the bazaar or anything like that. Well, there was no point in it.
Were you ever invited into the sergeant's mess
at all? Only at Christmas time. And their main object was to get the officers drunk. But that was the time. The sergeants, of course, were very well off too. They had their own ceremony. They always wore white mess kit every night. They changed every night. And the RSM and the bandmaster were in charge. The bandmaster was actually, funny enough, senior to the regimental sergeant major, which I never understood why, but he was. So, of course, he was in charge of the mess. He was a big man, the bandmaster. And they used to wear a white mesket, and it was really a very nice setup. They had their own ante room, like we did, their own mess, and of course their own bearers. You see, the British troops were far better off out there because they had their own. Well, I say the British troops, they had a bearer between five or six of them who'd make their bed, clean their uniform, do their boots, you know, all that sort of thing, which meant a lot to a British soldier. They'd all club together and pay them, you know, £5 a week or whatever it is to do it, you see. So he's quite well off.
This was the non-commissioned officers?
These are the private soldiers. They had theirs. The non-commissioned officers had their own corporal's mess. And the sergeants had their own mess, and of course the officers had their own mess. We lived in bungalows, you see, quite close to the camp, where the barrack rooms, where the soldiers lived and the sergeants lived. We were actually outside. And we had bungalows down a road, all British officers, all carrying four people per bungalow, which gave your own bedroom and your own sitting room and your, as I say, the tub bath. Well, I had a most unfortunate accident. I was driven over the Khyber Pass, which was very sad. What happened, I went up with a friend of mine, and she wanted to see the Hindu Kush, which you could see from there, the Dakota very well. We were dining, actually we were lunching with the staff captain up there, and rather like lunches, they had brandies on the lawn at 4:30, you know, that sort of lunch. And she said, oh, can I? I had a little Hillman Minx, it was called in those days. And I said, well, you can borrow it. And I'll go back with your sister. Now, the sister was the husband, the wife of the RAF intelligence officer, who wasn't there. She had a big American car. I said, all right, I'll drive back. And I said, I'd like to drive, because I know the Khyber backwards. But she insisted that she'd drive. And that's the last, really, that I remember, because apparently we hit a bridge. It went over into a nullah, which is a riverbed. It was dry, of course, at that time of year. And I was found about 30 yards from the car. Smashed car and my wrist, everything broken, smashed up in it. That was about 6 hours later by a shepherd.